October. Lowell, Heartland, New Brunswick.
I wrote some more stuff about my family of wolves. Whatever it is I'm writing, it's starting to take shape, I think. Kaibo was gone. He had taken up Yoka's post in the early morning so that the Omega could sleep, and then snuck out before the rest of us woke up. Sertan bit Yoka's front leg hard enough to break hide. I had to get in between them, lick Sertan's lips, and growl before he would release him. We caught Kaibo scent in the air outside of the farmhouse. We could tell he was moving south. Xyla couldn't understand it. She was still too young. But Sertan knew. Kaibo had decided to turn around and face the desperate ones alone. We weren't about to follow him. A week earlier, our pack stood at 20 strong. Now we were down to 4. Kaibo had been my youngest. My blood ran hot in his veins. We let him crusade south with a grim acceptance as we forced ourselves farther into the north. Last night, at this bed and breakfast I was staying at in Jacksonville, I had some weird dreams. I woke up with my face down in the pillow and I freaked out because I was suffocating. Strange way to start the day. This river valley is gorgeous. All the leaves have just turned so... There's just so much color everywhere. Orange, and reds, and yellows, and purples, and browns. Like a painting. It was good to see JP again in Fredericton. It was good to see him, hear his voice, hear him laughing again. When I close my eyes, if I close them really hard, I can almost be there again with them. In Fredericton, at the tables outside the cafe. If I close my eyes even harder, I can almost be back in Lawrencetown with him when we were kids. Going surfing with him and Connor and Jane. I keep thinking about how no one's heard from Connor in years. It's weird how friends can just go missing. People that mean so much to you. Today, I'm going to be conducting a little investigation in the town of Heartland. Like the Hardy Boys, or Columbo, or something. I came across some odd stories when I was at the hospital in Waterville, and I want to check them out if I can. Patients disappearing from their beds. Some house cats found mutilated in the woods outside the parking lot. Maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Maybe it's not healthy for me to be... It's like when someone tells you that a house is haunted. And so you go look at the house, even though the last thing anyone really needs to see is a ghost.
Marjorie, 64, Heartland, New Brunswick.
I live in a nice little town, and there's nothing crazy going on in my life. And that's the way I'd like to keep it. I keep my nose clean, and I don't snoop. I don't gossip. Good Canadian. Evermore. Lyle was half gone with dementia before the cancer. Scared off most of his friends before anyone figured out it was dementia. He'd been a heavy drinker his whole life, and it doesn't matter if he was nice enough person when he was nice, because whenever he was on a binge, he was a disgusting man with a temper and... because he was an alcoholic. He was basically going off a binge almost every day of his life. He never saw that as a problem. Which was the problem. Most of his friends left him due to depression. Not Lyle's depression, but their own. because they'd get so depressed trying to help out their friend when he didn't see anything at all wrong with what he was doing to himself. Nothing wrong with having a drink or two in the morning. And then one after that. And then one after that. And then, why not drive to the liquor store for another six-pack? Because it's a fine afternoon after all, isn't it? And then driving down there again at 8 in the evening, because he'd finished the six-pack, and he needed another. And maybe a quart of rum on top of that to help him sleep. There was the chain-smoking on top of all that. He looked 20 years older than he ever was. And he was old enough to begin with. So his friends, his good friends, they'd get on him about this. And then he'd get defensive, because he'd been drinking and he wasn't quite sure about himself. And then he'd get scared for himself, and that'd make him angry. And the next thing you know, he'd be stomping around his apartment, knocking over chairs and screaming at his friends for being too hard on him, or not understanding him, which was all a bunch of nonsense. You can only offer someone help so many times, and if they keep refusing it, well, you wait and see if you get depressed or not. If you like the person to begin with, and you see them keep doing it to themselves. I mean, eventually you gotta cut ties, because it'll break you. Watching someone you love just go ahead and kill themselves, think that it's okay that they're doing that. And Emma Hansen has no business insinuating anything happened to him more nefarious than him just running out of there with his dementia and running off into the woods to meet his maker. I mean, my gosh, you hear stories all the time about those night shift nurses, especially the young ones taking naps through their shifts. Lyle had dementia. He'd had it for years. It had progressed, is what I'm trying to say. And what is she trying to do to suggest anything outside of that? Life is a lot more natural than people covering their tracks would have you believe. It's the first defensive tactic of a liar. Deflection. The nurses were napping on shift and a patient escaped. Oh, well, someone must be playing games. Sure. No one's playing games around here. They should take the German shepherds out around the woods. Around the hospital is what they should be doing. Just because a man doesn't have any friends left doesn't mean he has enemies. Other than himself. And I'm not trying to be hard on those nurses either. I know they work hard. I know they work long shifts. And I know the province can't afford to pay them right and all of that. But if they would just admit to the fact that they let him walk out of there, then everyone would know. And then there wouldn't be all this ridiculous gossip going around about Lyle, of all people. Now, I keep my nose clean. I don't pay attention to gossip. Good Canadian. Evermore. And let's say someone was playing games. I'm certainly not going to tell you about it, of all people. Because if someone is playing games and I tell you about it, and whoever is playing games finds out I told you anything, well, you're not the police or the RCMP. What kind of protection would I have if I told you anything? How much protection would I have if I ever told the RCMP? I'm just an old lady, living by herself because I took care of my health and I didn't drink myself stupid and give myself dementia prematurely. But what kind of protection could I expect from them? Let alone some kind of traveling writer kid. And you should know better than to be snooping around like some kind of Magnum PI. You don't have any protection. You don't even have anywhere to stay around here. I mean, you need to have your head examined, you ask me. Lyle's dead in the woods near that hospital. You mark my words. I keep my nose clean. So should you. And so should Emma Hansen. Good Canadian. Evermore. You should try and get some work. And get yourself a place to stay. You should try and get a job rather than whatever it is you call this that you're doing. And that's the last of the tea. When you're finished that, I got no more. I gotta go to the store tomorrow to get some more. This isn't the city. It's dark outside. Man could come into your home at night and kill you, and that'd be it. And no one would ever know until 4 or 5 days later, unless the Mormons came by trying to convert you, and they catch whiff of the smell. Everyone thinks that gossiping and making up stories protects them somehow. I keep my nose clean.
Wade, 51, Florenceville, Bristol, New Brunswick.
I'm not sure if we'll be keeping you that long, to be honest. Work will start winding down pretty quick. Basically just got a bunch of here and there stuff for you. It's not been that great of a harvest either. Not been that great of a year, to be completely honest. Weather just wasn't right. And then all that rain during haying season. I'll be lucky if it doesn't rot half of it halfway through January. I'll probably have to buy some off the neighbors. That'll cut into everything. And a shitty yield. Everything too small. The distributor's giving me some horse shit about the potatoes we sent him last year. Had to dicker around with the contract because they're worried about the yield next year being like this year. And then the animals on top of everything. The cows, eh? There's something wrong with the cows. Don't know what the hell's up with them. The milk tastes funny. Can't figure out why. They're acting weird out in the pasture and the milk tastes funny. All of the milk. All of the milk doesn't taste like milk should. And I think it's because they're freaked out about something, but I can't figure out what the hell they have to be freaked out by. I mean, they're cows. It's not like we stopped looking after them. They have all these goddamn fields to graze, but they're not even grazing like they normally do. Some of them are starting to look lean. I brought the vet out to check them out, but that cost an arm and a leg, of course, and he doesn't know what's wrong with them. One of them tried to bite him, he said, which I figured was horse shit, but he charged me a little heavy too, and I think that's why. Because he thought one of them tried to bite him, but he thought I thought he was full of horse shit. Could just be a down year. You have down years sometimes on the farm. But we had a great year last year, and we were all set to go start a spring and got a head start on everything. And then June came along, and it's just been one thing after the other. All sorts of stupid little things. Pulled the kid a couple of days from school so he could lend a hand. The wife nearly took a strip out of my hide for that when she found out, which is why I'm bringing you on board. Though I hope I don't have to for very long. No offense, it's just been a heck of a haul lately. You don't know how to drive a tractor, and that's a pain in the ass. I suppose I'll have to get Dick to run the tractor then. Just be here tomorrow, bright and early, we'll get you started. However long we keep you. However long you last. You're not gonna write about that stuff I said about the distributors, are you? You should probably edit that stuff out. I need the money. You just find yourself stuck most of the time. You know the work that's got to get done. The work, it's stuff you've known since you were a kid. And because you were a kid, when you learn the work, you know why it's got to get done, so there's no putting it off. I remember seeing my dad when I was a kid and seeing how tired the work made him and the headaches he used to get. By the end of some days, he'd have migraines so bad he'd skip supper to go lie down on the couch, and you couldn't talk to him. And we'd have to tiptoe around the house if he was like that, because any noise we made would set him off. Takes a hell of a lot of stress to make a man get like that. When I was a kid, I'd see him like this and think to myself, I'm never going to get like that. I'm sure as hell never going to become a farmer. I thought that right up until grade 12. Right until I had to choose between working on the farm and going to university. Now you see those universities struggling with enrollment and their professors going on strike every other year. And you hear about people with degrees working at Tim Hortons all over the place, or driving a cab. It's like they present you with two doors when you're heading out of high school. A door on the left and a door on the right. You know what's behind the first door? Misery and pain. Headaches and sore joints and all the joy life brings. And you know what's behind the second door? Misery and pain, headaches and sore joints, and all the joy life brings. So you tell me, which door are you supposed to choose? Or you could just become a drifter, I guess. But bright and early, I mean 5 a.m.
Keith, 57, Perth, Andover, New Brunswick.
You will see some of the prettiest sunrises you've ever seen in your entire life on your way home from work. The end of the shift is the best thing about the job. When you're driving in your car on your way home, I know you don't have a car, but when you walk home, I know you're staying with the Briggses, but when you get your own place, or even when you just walk into the Briggses, the sunrise here is beautiful. It's slow rising over the hills on the other side of the valley, across the river. The hills on the Andover side of Perth Andover. The motel here is on the Perth side of Perth Andover. The bridge takes you to the Andover side. The other good part about the job is that it's usually pretty quiet. That's the nice thing about starting your shift at midnight. Pretty quiet. You might get the odd call from a visitor, but that's it. Oh, we're on the bus stop too for the area, but the only bus that'll come through on your shift is the one coming back from Montreal heading to Halifax. That usually gets here about 7 a.m., so you might get a few people needing to use the washroom, which is fine. And the driver, he'll pick up any mail or packages we have here for him. We keep all the mail and packages together here, just under the desk. As you can see, it's not very many. It's usually only one or two packages here for them. Usually not even that many. Any of the visitors call you in the night? Well, the closets around the corner has extra towels and blankets, ice buckets. If you want to take a smoke break, just walk out the front door here. We don't let the day staff do that, but the night shift can in between midnight and 6 a.m. I would bring a book, or I guess you could bring a notepad and work on those stories you've been telling me about. Not too bad of a job for that. You could get all sorts of writing done here. You could write a book. If you see anyone drive up and park in the lot, you don't need to approach them. If you see anyone parking and they're suspicious, you can just call the RCMP. The detachment's really close by, so they don't mind checking it out for you. Sometimes you get drivers pulling in here to sleep in their cars overnight. Nothing major. The RCMP will wake them up for you and get them moving again. Really, though, I don't care if people pull in here and sleep in their vehicles. It's better than them getting into an accident and hurting themselves or someone else. I had a friend once. He had fallen asleep driving. He said that he remembered he was behind the wheel driving, and the next thing he knew, he was waking up in the hospital 7 months later. He'd been in a coma. Fell asleep at the wheel, and the car went off the road and into a tree. He was lucky. It was just a head injury, but was all right once it healed up and he regained consciousness. Actually, now that I think of it, that's not all he remembered. He didn't remember this until a while after he got out of the hospital, but he said, and this was months after he had woken up, he said he started remembering things from when he was in a coma, like dreams, except they weren't quite dreams. He said they were like lucid type dreams, like choose your own adventures. He was dreaming, but he could make decisions in the dreams. In one of the dreams, it's funny, I'd forgotten this until now. I haven't spoken to this friend in like 8 years or something. I'd forgotten all about this. In one of these coma dreams, my friend was walking through the woods. He was just walking in the woods, but he was lost, no idea where he was, and then suddenly he comes into this clearing in the middle of the woods, and there's an old man standing there in the middle of the clearing, and my friend, he didn't know how he knew this. You know how in dreams sometimes you just know things for some reason? Anyway, my friend said as soon as he walked into this clearing, as soon as he saw this old man, he knew the old man was God. Like the Lord, God, and God handed him these three big books. And so my friend, he opened the books, and all of the pages in the books, they were completely blank. And so he asked God, why he was giving him these books. He told God he didn't understand. And so God, this old man, told him, God said to my friend that each one of these books represented my friend's life, and God was going to give him three chances to write a life with a happy ending. Then all of a sudden, my friend was an embryo again, inside his mother's womb, and he was born again, and he was an infant again, and he was a toddler again, and so on. And my friend had to live his life all over again, but while he was in a coma. He told me that the dream time worked like actual time, like he had to go through life again each time, and that it took as long as it did in real life. And all the decisions he made mattered, and then he got to make different decisions than he had in his real life. So the first time he does this, he goes through his life again, he ends up getting married and then divorced, and right after he gets divorced, he dies from a heart attack when he's running this marathon. And after he dies, he finds himself back in the clearing in the woods, and God is standing there, and God takes one of the books out of his hands, and the book turns to ash, and God, the old man, says to him, two books left. And then my friend is inside his mother's womb again, and so he goes through his entire life again in real time, again while still in the coma. And this time he's really depressed and really, really scared about failing at his life again. And the pressure on him gets so intense that he starts using cocaine, and he gets addicted to cocaine, and he winds up in this fight with this drug dealer in Halifax, and the drug dealer stabs him, and all of a sudden he's back in the clearing with God, the old man. And God takes another book from him, and the book turns to ash. One book left. And my friend, he finds himself in his mother's womb again, but this time something was different. All of a sudden the dream, it's not choose your own adventure anymore. The dream, all of a sudden, it's not a lucid dream anymore. He has to live his life all over again, in real time, just like he did in real life, before he was in the coma. So he's like a prisoner inside himself, watching himself make all those original choices again, watching himself make all those decisions again, and so it comes to the night where he's driving on the highway at night, and he falls asleep, and then all of a sudden he's in the clearing in the woods with God again. And so God looks at him, and then he looks at the book my friend is holding, the last book. And then God looks at my friend again, and God looks into my friend's eyes. And my friend told me that's when he woke up out of his coma. Crazy, eh? And I only remember this because you were telling me about those stories you were working on. Almost like you were trying to write some book of your own, eh? Aren't you? Right now, the sun is rising around 8 o'clock on the dot. Pretty much exactly when you're off work. So you got some nice end of shift walks ahead of you. Best part of the shift, you ask me. See the beginning of each and every brand new day that ever was. You're going to need to get the haircut, though. There's a barber in town over on the Andover side.
Eva, 33, Perth Andover, New Brunswick.
All right. Now? Now talk? Yes? Talk now? Yes? Eva Buma. I'm 33 years old and originally from Shediac. But I'm working now as a massage therapist here in Perth Andover because my husband got a job up here through forestry. And the reason I am here to talk to you is because my friend Keith Forrest told me I should come here and talk to you and tell you my story because you're trying to write a book. Keith can be a bit of a weirdo sometimes, but he's also a really nice guy. If he gave you a job, you know that already. He was pretty insistent on me talking to you, so here goes. There's something happening here in Perth Andover. Something major. And no one really knows what it is. Just a preface so you know a little bit about Perth Andover. This has always been a pretty quiet place. It's a small community, like a lot of other communities up and down the river valley. Except we're bigger than a place like Bath, or even Florenceville, really. Where I work,
We're right along the river in the Andover side here of Perth Andover. And lately, I mean for the last 2 weeks, really, the number of times the RCMP or the paramedics or the fire trucks have sped past the parlor with their sirens going has started to get crazy. They're going by a lot. They're going by so much it makes me feel like something is going on. So one of my clients, he's a reporter, and I was giving him a massage on Saturday, and the RCMP went screaming by the parlor, and he remarked about it. So we got to talking about it while I was giving him his massage. So my client, he tells me that people are going missing up upriver, and that the people up there are freaking out. And my client, he tells me it's not like a couple people have gone missing. My client says that over 15 people have gone missing from the reserve in the last month. And according to him, he says the RCMP have no idea what's going on up there either. He said they figured it must have been some kind of a gang thing or a family up there fighting another one because you know how politics can kind of get a bit crazy on the reserve sometimes. But he said he went up there himself and he says it's not like that at all. He says people up there are genuinely scared about what's happening. He says it's not drug-related. He says it's not some kind of family feud. He says the men up there are loading their shotguns and putting them beside their beds at night. He says the elders up there are telling everyone to not leave their houses after dark and to not let their children out of their sight. And the RCMP, they've taken the dogs up there. They've been sending the planes overhead with the infrared, but they don't know what's happening. And they aren't talking to the press or anyone else about it. Neither are the paramedics or the fire department. No one will talk about it, except for a few of the elders upriver, because they're scared for their community. Now, my client works for the newspaper, and of course, all the newspapers in New Brunswick are owned by the Irvings. So you don't know for 100% it isn't the Irvings just trying to drum up some kind of a panic through the media. I read that in a Naomi Klein book once, how corporations like drumming up emergency situations in certain places because it's easier to operate and get things in place if people are all riled up and scared and the like. I don't know if the Irvings have ever wanted to buy land up near the reserve or what, or if that has anything to do with what's going on right now. But something is happening. Something is sending those vehicles upriver with the sirens going. It's never been this often before. Even that last big flood we had, the sirens weren't going this often. And that flood nearly ended us. It nearly took everything we ever had from us. So something must be going on. And my client, he says there's going to be this big expose about it in the paper this week. Again, hopefully this isn't some kind of scheme the Irvings are pulling. This community, we got real untrustful about a lot of things after that last flood. Floods are horrible things. They destroy communities. Maybe there's some kind of explanation for it. Something really silly, like a bunch of people getting together and deciding to go have a party somewhere and it got out of hand or something, I don't know. But when the rational explanations you try coming up with start sounding more fantastic than the irrational ones, that's when you, I don't know, figure out what's going on and let people know about it so that everyone's not living in the dark, you know? People who live in the dark all the time, they end up going crazy, don't they? I mean, unless that's your job, I mean, working all night. The graveyard shift. But that's not what I was talking about. It's not what I'm here to talk about. Well, people have trouble murdering one person and getting rid of the evidence. How could you murder 15 and hide the evidence? I don't think it's even possible. Is it?
Sabrina, 28, Perth Andover, New Brunswick.
A bunch of white people not making a big deal out of a bunch of missing Indigenous people. That part of the whole thing don't surprise me. It's not like it hasn't happened before. Indigenous people going missing or getting murdered or raped, and white people not giving a crap. But this is happening just upriver. The reserve is so close to here. It's just upriver a bit. Very close to where white people live. So why aren't people making a big deal of it down here? Why isn't it in the paper? I was speaking to a reporter just last week. What happened to him? He said he was writing a story about it. Unless somebody found out. He was writing a story about it and didn't want him to. I mean, everybody knows the Irvins. They own all the newspapers in New Brunswick. Maybe they don't want people getting riled up around here for some kind of business reason. Who knows? And maybe they're telling the government to keep things hush-hush about it. Because everyone knows Irvin controls the government too. And why isn't anyone talking about it? We hooked up in university. Me and James. My husband. Over in school in Presque Isle. Just finished our degrees and James decided he wants to come back here. Come back home. To the res. Put his education to good use. He decided he wanted to make a difference. So we moved back to the reserve to start living the life again. And James, he wants to shake everything up. Get involved in the politics. Make some changes in the place. Well, that went over like a brick through a church window. They didn't like that too much. If you can understand, see, we moved away from the res. We moved away with no plans of returning. People thought of us as gone for good. Then one day we show up again, out of the blue, with James on a mission, on some kind of crusade to fix the place. People don't like outsiders telling them how to fix their own lives. And here I am, stuck with such a man. I never wanted to come back. I came back for James. And James wouldn't listen to me. He wouldn't tone down his act at all, and so... They're all huddled together now. Everyone left up there. They're hunkering down, patrolling the streets in their warrior garb, driving their ATVs around. They barricaded the entrances, started a couple bonfires. You could see them from across the river if you drive up around Andover. With the barricades, no one gets in or out except the residents or the RCMP, because they have to let them through. But their patrols and their barricades ain't worth that much. They found our truck on the side of the road, outside the res. James had gone out to gas up the truck, because the gas station is right outside the res. So he passed back through the barricade to drive back home. He must have, but he never made it. Whatever it is got to him before he could come home to me. And because it's James, right? I mean, everyone they made the proper noises, they all said, well, he's our brother. And we'll never give up on him. We'll find him. We will never stop looking and all of that. I mean, I believe some people were happy he was gone. Just his truck on the side of the road. Key still in ignition. Lights still on. Engine still running. Doesn't happen. Can't happen today. It's impossible. And nobody has any answers. And the RCMP and the government doesn't know anything? No, thank you. No, thank you. I hope you take what I'm saying right now, that you take it and tell everyone you know. Tell every single other white person out there that something is happening to us. And because they're handling it in the way that they are, this will hurt them. This kind of thing breaks trust between the races, between people. As if there was any left. I think we're all in a lot of trouble. I think we're all screwed. You tell them that.
Lauren, 26, Perth Andover, New Brunswick.
I couldn't get comfortable on the bus. I'm too big for the seats. That headrest is just a little too low. The round part of it presses against that bump in the lower part of my skull in the back, so every little bump the bus hits kind of bounces my head off the headrest, and it pretty much sucked. Once you get to Ontario, the buses change. They're run by a different company or something. I like the Ontario buses better. I can get comfortable in those seats better. I'm coming straight from Toronto, so yeah, a little sleep would have been okay. Kind of a long trip without sleep. But there's something calming about riding in the bus in the middle of the night, when they turn off the lights, and you can turn on the overhead fan, and there's just those little hallway mini lights that are on. It's easier on the eyes. And the cool air from the fan is nice. I can just kind of pop on my headphones and kind of coast through the night, look out at the landscape through the windows. Last night was pretty clear, so I could kind of look at the moon and the stars and everything. If it wasn't for the bus seat, it would have been great. I tried putting my jacket underneath my head as a pillow, but I couldn't ever seem to get it just right for some reason. But other than my seat, it was nice. I had lots to think about, anyway, with my grandfather dying and all that. He passed away in the home in Andover. That was just a couple of days ago. It was apparently pretty peaceful. Natural. So? When Dad called me, I wasn't expecting it for a bunch of reasons. First, because me and Dad don't get along. And he never calls me. And we don't talk much. Even when he called me, that was a 10-second conversation. Your grandfather's dead. Okay, I'll take the bus and be there Friday morning. Click. Gramps had been in the home so long, I just kind of got used to... This sounds bad, but I just kind of got used to him being old and away from us, like, in the home, and I didn't really get around to visiting him that much. So part of me kind of took it for granted, and part of me must have kind of just gotten used to him always being there. I know that sounds bad, but I've been thinking about it on the bus. I took it for granted, his being in the home. You know, when you live in the city, you kind of stop looking at the stars. Because of the light pollution in the city, you can't see as many, so the light pollution makes them appear fainter and farther away. So after a while, you just kind of stop looking at the stars. The cityscape kind of becomes your stars. After a while, you stop looking at the stars and start looking at the cityscape, and the cityscape becomes your stars. But the stars are still up there. They're burning as bright as they ever have, past the smog and the light pollution. But you kind of stop thinking about them. On the bus ride back here, that stretch between Rivière du Loup and Edmonton, that is dark country. You get to see the stars again. Start to remember what they were. Start to remember how beautiful they were. How much they meant to you. How much you loved them. So, the city. I like the city. I like Toronto. I got right wrapped up in Toronto. I know it sounds bad, but I forgot about Gramps. Kind of like my parents seem to have forgotten about me now, which is totally weird because usually if Dad doesn't want to pick me up, Mom is here with the van. I'm sure I told Dad Friday. The bus only comes east this time in the morning. I can wait a few more minutes. You don't mind if I grab a coffee? I got buddies in town from growing up. Someone will come get me at some point. The only thing I really ever miss about Toronto, though, is the amount of people there. The stars aren't as bright, but you're always surrounded by people. I find that's the hardest thing to adjust to when you leave the city. There's so few people around you. Especially here in New Brunswick. The population problem, everyone leaving for out west, because this place is dead. Relatively, at least. Dad and me don't get along, but they're always here. Usually. Maybe the van broke down.
Fortune of Wolves was written by Ryan Griffith. The series was produced by Big Noise Audio Collective and presented by Theatre New Brunswick. The show was directed by Ryan Griffith with help from Gillian Hansen. Recording, editing, and sound design by Matt Carter. Music for the series was created by Counting On Downstairs with additional scoring by Matt Carter. To learn more about the series and the artists involved, visit tnb.nb.ca or look for the Big Noise Audio Collective on Facebook. This episode featured Kat Hall as the Chief Archivist, Jason McIntyre as Lowell, Julie Johnson as Marjorie, Ian Murphy as Wade, Ben Harrison as Keith, Victoria Urquhart as Eva, Natalie Sapier as Sabrina, and Ryan Tapley as Lauren.
Next time on Fortune of Wolves.
There are rumblings. Rumblings all over up here.
We think it's got to be like some kind of cult.
It looks like the corpse of some animal that has began to rot after it dies.
Do you know how a fish in a cave begins to see in the dark?
And Melinda was poor because she didn't have enough seashells and was barely scraping by and had to eat seaweed her whole life and didn't even have any pearls. This is how the story starts. I'm trying to develop it into a screenplay.